subcontinent can listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 25 meters, 11,645 kilohertz, every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 megahertz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Iran Sat or Bat 5 and Intelsat 39 and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
From our imams, the ninth imam is the first, whose imamat began at a very young age, about 8 or 9.
As-salamu alayka ya Abu Ja'far, Muhammad ibn Ali al-Barrat.
Peace be upon you, O Abu Ja'far, Muhammad the son of Ali, the righteous, the pious.
This is Dialogue, a program on the famous conversations of Imam Muhammad ibn Ali al-Jawad alayhi salam. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. I'm your host Mahdi, and we're talking about the dialogues of Imam al-Jawad alayhi salam. Imam Muhammad ibn Ali al-Jawad alayhi salam was the ninth divinely appointed imam from among the household of the Messenger of Allah. And Imam al-Jawad alayhi salam was also the direct descendant of the Holy Prophet. We find that Imam al-Jawad alayhi salam lived a short period of his holy life in the city of Baghdad. While he was in the city of Baghdad, he tended towards knowledge and wisdom, and his eminence established the basis and the principles of knowledge, and he made use of the period of his stay in Baghdad in order to spread knowledge and wisdom and teach the different sciences and to merge the intellect with the Islamic sciences and literature. A great number of scholars and narrators joined Imam al-Jawad alayhi salam to learn from his eminence the different Islamic sciences such as theology, philosophy, jurisprudence, and the interpretation of the Quran, the tafsir.
IRIB English Radio. Our website is parstoday.ir.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
Welcome back, dear listeners. It's an honor to have you with us. You're listening to Dialogue on IRIB English Radio. So, dear friends, we're talking about the dialogues of Imam al-Jawad alayhi salam. He is the ninth divinely appointed Imam. We find that Imam al-Jawad alayhi salam spoke to his companions, his friends, and the people in general about various moral and ethical qualities. Now, these moral and ethical qualities were very important because we find that in the era in which Imam al-Jawad alayhi salam lived in, this era was full of moral and ethical corruption and decadence. Now, this status quo of the environment, of course, was understandable because the rulers and the leaders at that time, namely the Abbasid governmental establishment, did not emphasize moral or ethical virtues. And so, over time, the Muslim Ummah and the Muslims began to lose that original pure Muhammadan Islam. And as we know, once moral and ethical corruption begins, then faith and iman also leaves one's heart and one's soul. In one such dialogue where Imam al-Jawad alayhi salam was speaking with his companions, he said to them, "Being ungrateful to the blessings of Allah causes detestation. It causes hatred." Now, of course, this detestation and this hatred that comes about is the hatred or the wrath from both the Almighty Allah and from the people. And this is because from the people we receive certain blessings, because the people are a means via which the Almighty Allah sends us certain blessings. Of course, the ultimate source of blessings and all of the beautiful things that we have in our existence and in our life is ultimately from the Almighty Allah. And so first and foremost, we must be grateful to the Almighty Allah. We must be thankful to the Almighty Allah because it is the most generous and the most beneficent and the most merciful, the Almighty Allah, that has given us all the blessings that we have in our lives. And of course, along with the Almighty Allah, we should also be grateful to people, because people are the means via which we receive some of these blessings. And so it is necessary for us to always be grateful to the blessings that Allah has given us. And as the Almighty Allah says in the Holy Quran, if you are to be grateful to the blessings of Allah, Allah will increase you in your blessings. This is Dialogue, Imam al-Jawad alayhi salam.
And now we invite you to listen to a shorter speech by Sheikh Ayyub Rashid.
Respected brothers and sisters, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Imam al-Jawad alayhi salam, among the debates which he had within Aqaid, number one, there was issue which are regarding, is connected with mas'ala of Allah, ru'yatullah. This debate up to today, there are many people who talk that Allah can be seen. And Allah will be seen. When you talk about seeing Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, it is like you suppress your inner eye to see that which is immaterial. And you want to see only with this naked eye in order for you to prove things. But life doesn't go like that all the time. And it was here the ayah which was mentioned in Surah An-Naml, ayah number 106, about La tudrikuhu al-absar wa huwa yudriku al-absara wa huwa al-latif al-khabir. Allah, eyes can never see him, but he can perceive them. Imam al-Jawad used this ayah and many verses in the Holy Quran to prove that it is impossible people can see Allah, not in this world and not in akhirah. Because when you see Allah, if you say that Allah can be seen, then you put him in a specific place and you will make Allah limited, and then you will treat him like any other creature, and then you will have to say he has got a beginning and end, and Allah doesn't have those whatever human qualities we talk about. Allah is beyond that. And Surah Al-Ikhlas is very clear.
Thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of Dialogue. Don't forget to visit our website at parstoday.ir/EN Call of Islam page, where you can find all of our previous programs and many other great programs as well. Until another episode, fi amanillah, and God bless you all.
Fires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
More than 830 UK health professionals and representatives from leading medical bodies have signed a letter to the Prime Minister, Rishi Sunak, expressing grave concerns that the government's plan to send asylum seekers to Rwanda will cause catastrophic mental and physical harm to people seeking safety. The letter says, subjecting people seeking sanctuary in the UK, many of whom have mental health conditions and have histories of torture, trafficking and trauma, to such an inhumane process is a matter of significant concern for the medical community. Like Brexit, the government's plan to send asylum seekers to Rwanda has split the UK down the middle. According to a poll carried out by a think tank this month, almost half of those surveyed backed the deal. The scheme, which would see the UK pay Rwanda $145 million over the next 5 years, has faced backlash from NGOs, asylum seekers, and a civil service trade union that questions its legality, leading the government to delay its execution. Under the government's illegal migration bill, the ones who do make it to the UK won't be admissible to have their asylum claim assessed, even if they are refugees coming from war-torn societies. Instead, they will face immediate removal either to their country of origin or a third country like Rwanda. The government's plan comes as most of the asylum seekers qualify to have their claims considered in the UK under international law, and the government cannot declare them inadmissible forcefully. The government insists that the plan to send asylum seekers to Rwanda is workable and an essential deterrent to prevent large numbers of people crossing the channel. So far, no flights have taken place after the first scheduled flight to the African nation was stopped at the 11th hour back in June, due to an intervention by the European Court of Human Rights, followed by months of legal challenges which have since stalled the program. Last year, a record 45,756 people crossed the channel in small boats. So far this year, more than 5,000 have made the crossing, a similar figure to this time last year before the Rwanda announcement was made. In December, the High Court in London ruled the British government's plan to send thousands of migrants to Rwanda lawful. But that decision is being challenged by asylum seekers. At the start of a four-day hearing on Monday, the refugees' lawyers argued that the plan is unlawful because the East African country is not safe. The lawyers told the court that the government had failed to tread the line between deterring migrants and remaining within Britain's human rights obligations. However, lawyers representing the British government stressed that its deal with Rwanda is subject to an exacting set of monitoring arrangements, including by the UN High Commissioner for Refugees, who has intervened in the appeal. Rwanda says migrants will be treated with respect and dignity, and the deal will offer them better opportunities. One of the three judges hearing the case said the issue of the safety of Rwanda would be the core issue. The charity Freedom from Torture, which is intervening as a third party in the appeal after having provided the High Court with evidence during deliberations last year, said Home Secretary Suella Braverman's policy poses a risk. Separately, two charities are warning that the illegal migration bill could lock up thousands of refugee children who have become separated from their parents. According to an impact assessment by the Refugee Council, it estimates that about 15,000 unaccompanied children would have their asylum claims deemed inadmissible in the first 3 years of the implementation of the legislation. As a result, those children could be detained or face deportation to the country they have fled or a third country, such as Rwanda. They could also be banned from remaining in the UK as refugees when they turn 18.
Fighting persists in Sudan despite several ceasefire agreements between the army and the paramilitary group known as the Rapid Support Forces, or RSF. The deadly conflict, which has so far claimed hundreds of lives and displaced many others, has brought much of the country's vital infrastructure to a standstill. Water and power have been cut and hospitals are damaged and closed.
The situation is very, very tense. No one really knows what is happening. It doesn't sound like it's de-escalating at all. And any attempts to have a humanitarian ceasefire have failed, it seems. So it's unclear what's going to happen next.
People find it almost impossible to provide their basic necessities. Weary residents must stand in line for bread in neighborhoods largely emptied of civilian life. Many are trapped or stranded in their homes, risking theft and looting if they venture out.
We can't sleep. We haven't slept in the past 4 days. We try to catch a few naps here and there, but it's not helping at all. We haven't left our house.
In the suburbs of three main cities of Khartoum, Bahri, and Omdurman, where are scenes of heavy clashes, people lock suitcases long distances by foot towards bus stops as they try to flee those areas and seek refuge in countries like Chad and South Sudan. According to UN estimates, some 2,000 Sudanese have so far arrived in South Sudan, most of them women and children. Non-stop airstrikes, shelling, and gun battles have ripped across the city day and night. The RSF says it has embedded itself in several neighborhoods, taking over buildings and other residential places. The army, on the other side, has used airstrikes and heavy artillery to try to force its rivals back. Army officials said they are trying to clear what they called hotbeds of rebel groups from the capital, Khartoum. Heavy gunfire and deadly airstrikes have prompted so many countries to withdraw their citizens and nationals from the Northeast African nation. Saudi Arabia, Egypt, France, Turkey, the Netherlands, Belgium, Sweden, the UK, the US, and so many other countries have already evacuated their citizens or have deployed soldiers and provided flights to secure their return. Some other nations, including Canada, have suspended their operations in Sudan amid heavy fighting there. The decision by many of world countries to evacuate their citizens from Sudan comes more than a week after clashes broke out between rival forces, the army led by Abdel Fattah al-Burhan and the RSF commander Mohamed Hamdan Daglo, known as Hemeti. The cause of the conflict? Tensions over the planned integration of RSF into Sudan's regular army. Many around the globe have warned that the conflict could plunge the country into a deeper chaos. This comes to the spotlight, especially when outside forces are further complicating the situation by providing arms or other military and financial assistance to either of the warring sides there. But what help would withdrawing foreign nationals from Sudan provide? Many argue that with foreign countries evacuating their diplomatic staff, it will be easier to put pressure on armed rivals to agree to a longer and more effective ceasefire. That, however, raises questions as to whether the conflict, which is merely an existential power struggle on both sides as many put it, will ever come to an end. Observers believe it is very unlikely that the two military commanders will ever come to the negotiating table and resolve differences. With that possibility being in the sight, there are national and international ramifications regarding the conflict. On the international level, one major consequence would be the exodus of refugees all moving toward the borders of Europe. That will eventually create a huge burden for the European countries, which are already grappling with the fallout of the US wars in Iraq, Syria, and Afghanistan, or Libya and many other countries for that matter, with influx of migrants seeking refuge there. Maybe that's why world countries, especially those in Europe and Sudan's neighbors, must join hand in hand to bring this deadly conflict to an end. At home, the longer they battle it out in city streets, the higher the civilian toll will climb and the harder it will be for either general to rule over the wreckage. If not, it can be expected that a major tragedy will be just around the corner. What seems to be of high urgency for Sudan is that this country, which has been the hotbed of back-to-back military coups, has to be ruled by a civilian-led democracy, something that the Sudanese people have long been calling for and for which they have paid a heavy price. Israel is on the decline. That's what the leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, highlighted during a meeting with ambassadors of Islamic nations in the Iranian capital Tehran on Saturday. Ayatollah Khamenei further underlined that the deterrent power of the Israeli regime is coming to an end. The leader said several decades ago, Ben Gurion, one of the founders of the fake regime, said we'll be destroyed whenever our deterrent power ends. The world is currently witnessing this reality, and if nothing happens, the end of the usurping regime is close. The leader said this, too, is one of the blessings that has risen from the sacrifices of the devoted Palestinian youth in the West Bank and other occupied areas. The leader regarded the internal resistance of the Palestinian people and the risk-taking, sacrificing nature of its youth as the main causes of the miserable situation that exists in the Israeli regime. He said today's situation in the occupied territories proved that the more the Palestinians stand up and resist in different regions, the weaker the fake regime will become. Describing efforts by the Palestinian resistance movements as valuable, Ayatollah Khamenei noted that the resistance fronts and all Islamic countries should focus on strengthening the fighting elements inside Palestine. The leader pointed to the increasing support for the Palestinians around the globe, saying the participation of the Europeans in rallies to support the Palestinian people is very important, especially in countries that are dependent on the Israeli regime. Ayatollah Khamenei said anti-Israeli gatherings in the US and European countries are the result of the increasing revelations of the crimes of the regime in Tel Aviv. The leader further referred to the pioneership of the Islamic Republic in supporting the Palestinian issue, saying this movement will continue. He expressed hope that the beloved people of Iran will witness a day when Muslims of all Islamic countries will pray freely in Al-Quds. The remarks by the leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution come at a time when the Israeli regime is facing challenges both internally and externally. In the occupied territories, the regime has been witnessing months of protests and strikes in response to its push for broad judicial reforms. Protests have been taking place in a number of cities, including Tel Aviv, with demonstrators calling for the resignation of the entire Israeli cabinet. The protests all erupted after cabinet officials announced their decision to limit the Supreme Court's power. Protesters argued that the changes will foster corruption and bring about this isolation. The protests, with hundreds of thousands, sometimes millions of people participating in the weekly event, have become a huge burden for Israeli authorities. Some argue that the regime has ignited its own annihilation by proposing such reforms.
Other than that, political parties in Israel had previously failed to win the majority of votes to form a cabinet. That's of course before Netanyahu came to power after several back-to-back elections in 4 entire years. Even now that the Israeli premier has finally managed to form a coalition, there is no guarantee that it will survive given all the crises it is facing.
In the occupied territories, the regime has been carrying out almost daily raids into numerous Palestinian neighborhoods, killing and injuring them. Not to mention that most of those killed are teenagers and youths. The regime has also carried out raids into a number of religious sites, including the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound, triggering retaliatory attacks from Palestinians. From rocket attacks carried out from the Gaza Strip to shooting and car ramming operations in the occupied West Bank, the regime has been witnessing a strong resistance from Palestinians. After all, they're dealing with a generation that has literally nothing to lose and is ready to fight for its land, which has been taken away from its ancestors decades ago. On the international level, the regime is getting more isolated day after day by many countries around the globe, including those in Europe, with their capitals calling on the regime to put an end to its atrocities against Palestinians. The Israeli land grab and the subsequent illegal settlements in the occupied land are just a few among all the many crimes world countries are reacting against. Not to mention that the years-long Israeli blockade in Gaza has added to global anger against the regime. More broadly, with actions like boycott, divestment, sanctions, the BDS movement, which is a global decision to boycott Israeli products, it seems that the world countries are determined to further isolate the regime from different fronts. Maybe that's exactly what Iran's leader Ayatollah Khamenei refers to as the imminent end of the usurping Israeli regime.
He's called a wolf warrior. That is how China's new ambassador to the U.S. has been described. The hawkish Qin Gang, a close confidant of President Xi Jinping, enters the scene in Washington at a time of high tensions between China and the U.S. If the United States does not hit the brakes, but continues to speed down the wrong path, no amount of guardrails can prevent derailing, and there will surely be conflict and confrontation, he said. Qin Gang couldn't be more direct. With a statement like that, he set the tone for China's foreign policy for the coming year and beyond, and it couldn't be more combative. That should be no surprise. Chinese warnings have become normal, whereas in the past, it would spell a crisis. Just the other day, the Chinese Foreign Ministry threatened the U.S., saying that we will not allow anyone to interfere in bilateral relations between Beijing and Moscow. The U.S. is now getting a taste of its own medicine. After all, the U.S. has provoked China militarily and economically, and otherwise for that matter. The former Chinese ambassador to the U.S. has said China has never wanted to play a zero-sum game with the U.S. At a time when relations between the number one and two economies couldn't be worse, the foreign policies of these two superpowers are on opposite trajectories. China is moving full steam ahead. It has enhanced its standing on the global stage, and many of its directives go against U.S. interests, though unintentionally. When it comes to its national currency, the yuan, China spared no efforts to internationalize it, threatening the role of the U.S. dollar as a reserve currency. Take the latest visit by the Brazilian president to China. Lula da Silva called on developing countries to work towards replacing the U.S. dollar with their own currencies in international trade. De-dollarization also held true when the Chinese president recently visited Saudi Arabia and asked the GCC countries of the Persian Gulf to buy their commodities from China with the yuan. In another blow to the U.S., China was the final mediator between Iran and Saudi Arabia, which dealt a heavy blow to U.S.'s standing, not just when it came to its ally Saudi Arabia, but also in West Asia. The BRICS grouping of nations comprised of Russia, China, India, Brazil, and South Africa is another example of not only China's growing clout in countries supporting it, but how, when it comes to trade blocs, the U.S. is left behind. Let's not forget, Iran, Saudi Arabia, Argentina, and Algeria have also applied for membership. In addition to BRICS, other trade blocs which do not include the U.S. are RCEP, the SCO, and the EEU, the Eurasia Economic Union. And in an unprecedented move, the U.S. President Joe Biden announced recently actions to limit U.S. investments in China. Biden's executive order will limit U.S.-China economic engagement, as the measures would entail U.S. businesses restricting their investments in key parts of the Chinese economy. The U.S. is gradually losing its allies, like European ones, when it comes to the Ukraine war, as demonstrated by this stance by the French president after visiting China. These U.S. moves, however, are by design, since the U.S.'s ultimate goal is confronting China militarily in the South China Sea to provoke China the same way that it did Russia. That is, if the U.S. does not lose its proxy war in Ukraine. Which brings us to a suggestion by the former U.S. ambassador to China to the current officials of the White House, including the U.S. president.
So we can consider Sayyid Hadi Khosro Shahi.
Shahid Muhammad Baqir al-Sadr.
He was born in Kadhimiya.
The first and the most important thing that we can learn from Allama Tabatabai is his great effort.
In this regard, I should like to say that one of the great benefits of the late Ayatollah Sayyid Mahmoud Shahrudi was...
When we look at the works of late Rawzati, we see...
There is a famous sentence from Mirza Khalil Qamarani that he says in Farsi, Tuhid kalame baraye kalame tuhid.
Be more familiar with outstanding Shia figures in The Teacher.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum to the listeners of IRIB English Radio Call of Islam page. Well, welcome to another episode of the program The Teacher, an introduction into the thoughts and works of the most outstanding Muslim Shiite scholars and ulama. I am Atta, the host of this program. With me in the studio, we have two very special guest speakers from the Islamic House of Qom, Shaykh Rouhani and Shaykh Fadai. Shaykh Rouhani, assalamu alaikum.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
And Shaykh Fadai, assalamu alaikum to you.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Okay, for today's discussion, we want to talk about Muhammad ibn Ismail ibn Abdul Jabbar, mainly known as Abu Ali Ha'iri. He was one of the outstanding fuqaha and also the outstanding scholars in the field of Rijal, the author of Muntaha al-Maqal fi Ahwal al-Rijal. Of course, we'll talk more about the field of Rijal, what is this field of study, and why Abu Ali Ha'iri has compiled such a book, Muntaha al-Maqal. Before anything, let's be more familiar with his early life. Shaykh Rouhani, let's start with you, brother. Give us a picture of Abu Ali Ha'iri's early life.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Abu Ali Ha'iri was born in Karbala, though his father was from Mazandaran, the north part of Iran. So it is said that he claimed that he was the, let's say, the offspring of, among the offspring of Ibn Sina, but since Ibn Sina had no son, it was doubted by many other scholars.
Yes.
Anyhow, but he was one of the greatest scholars in Karbala, who actually had lots of great asatid and teachers like Aqa Muhammad Baqir Behbahani. He was known as Wahid Behbahani. and also Sayyid Ali Tabatabai and also Sayyid Bahrul Ulum.
Yes.
You know that they are very great scholars in the Shi'ite school of thought and the history of the Shayyo. And among the students of him, again, there are lots of great scholars. We can just name some of them, like Abdul Ali Rashti and Baghdadi Ha'iri and the other great scholars. And among the some of the works which were written by him is Muntaha al-Maqal fi Ahwal al-Rijal, which is about Rijal. This is one of the books that was like a ta'liq, like a commentary.
Yes.
On the Manhaj al-Maqali Istarabadi.
Yes.
So, of course, some of the great Shiite scholars like Aqa Buzurg Tehrani named him or mentioned his name with a very, let's say, great status among the Shiite scholars. That these are the points that we can mention about his life.
So many scholars had migrated from Iran to, for example, different cities of Najaf and Karbala in order to continue their studies over there. It seems that the houses of Najaf and Karbala were very much famous on that time, isn't it, Sheikh?
Yes, you know, his family originally were from Mazandaran, or as they called it that time, Tataristan, but they migrated to Iraq, Karbala. He was born in Karbala because his father migrated before that to the city. But the Hawza of Karbala was not so powerful or famous at that time. Najaf was the most important Hawza at that time. And the point that I can see in the life and biographies of ulama is that we had, during history of Hawza, we had three important Hawza. First, the Hawza of Hilla, and then the Hawza of Najaf, and after that, Hawza of Qom. As Ayatollah Khamenei, the Supreme Leader, mentioned once in the lecture that he had among the clergymen in Qom, maybe more than 15 years ago, I don't remember the dates exactly, he said, he was alerting Hawza about some of the problem. He said, pay attention that Hawza is a live creature, a live being. It has life and it has death. Once Hawza of Hilla was alive, then he died. And the power transferred to Najaf. And then the Hawza of Najaf didn't die completely, but he was weakened. And the power of Hawza, when I say power, I mean the scientific power.
Yes. You mean the spirit of the power.
The spirit of Hawza transferred to Iran. So as you can see, these ulama that we were talking about, all of them were taught in Hawza of Hilla and Najaf.
Yes.
But what happened that this power, this spiritual and scientific power of Hawza was transferred to Iran? That was one of the effects of Islamic revolution of Iran. That after this phenomenon, after this event, we can see that Hawza of Qom, which was not so great Hawza at that time, this Hawza started to grow, started to improve. As much as that, we can see that now the most important Hawza all around the world of Shia is Hawza of Qom, much more important and powerful and effective than Hawza of Najaf. Now the line is vice versa. In Najaf and Hilla, if they want to study Hawza, a seminary school, very well and good, they have to migrate to Iran and Qom.
Of course, so, the history of Islamic Hawza of Qom also dates back before Inqilab too, because we know that Haj Sheikh Abdul Karim Ha'iri...
But not as strong as it is now.
Yes. I mean, but now, because of the number of the students, international ones, you know, as you said, the presence of the Islamic ulama.
Of the attention that Islamic revolution gave to this Hawza, and it could grow in the science, different sciences.
That's right. Okay. And as you said, the atmosphere of the Hawza Ilmiya of Qom is very much different now. The institutes that are related, to, you know, the philosophy, the theology that are taught over there.
IRIB English Radio. Our website is parstoday.ir. You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir. La ilaha illallah.
La ilaha illallah. Okay, let's get back to Abu Ali Ha'iri and his outstanding work, Muntaha al-Maghal fi Ahwal al-Rijal. Sheikh Rouhani, I want you to explain a little bit for us about the field of Rijal. What is Rijal?
Yes, you know, for the Shiite scholars, it has been very much important and significant from the early life of the Shayyo till now, particularly in the time of the major occultation, Ghaiba of the Holy Imam, Imam al-Asr, ajallahu ta'ala, farajahu al-Sharif. It was very much important and significant for these scholars to completely and perfectly evaluate and assess the narrators, the transmitters of the hadith. Because when you, for example, refer to a hadith and, for example, drive a hukm of Islam from that hadith, mm-hmm. so in that hukm, millions of people will follow that hukm, will, let's say, perform that hukm in their lives. So that is very much important that that hukm of Islam, the ruling of Islam, must be based on a very trustable and truthful hadith. So now how can we identify that whether this hadith is a really true hadith or not? How can we trust to that transmitter or narrator of that hadith? That is why Ahwal al-Rijal means that to study about those people who are the transmitters of these hadith, the narrators of these hadith. So that is why a major part of the scholarly life of the great scholars of Shia were dedicated to study about what the life of these great transmitters mm-hmm. of hadith. That's to right. know that, okay, which one of these transmitters are trustworthy, which one of them can be trusted, which one of them are, for example, let's say, admitted.
Zaif, weak.
Admitted. Yes. Some of these narrators are admitted
yes, yes.
by the holy imams, mm-hmm. because some of them were the companions of the imams.
You mean trusted by the imams.
Yeah, yeah. Yes, the imam told us that you have to get our ahadith, our sayings from these people. Mm-hmm. So then we see that, okay, these people who were, for example, well qualified by the imam, then which one of the later transmitters are, for example, admitted by these people?
That's
this
right.
is very much important. Okay. So that's why Ilm al-Rijal is just a study about the lifestyle, which you can say about life, about biography, about all the, let's say, characteristics of these transmitters and the narrators of a hadith,
that's
which
right.
is one of the very important fields of studies in the Islamic Hausa of Shia.
Okay. And Muntaha al-Maghal fi Ahwal al-Rijal is related to this field of study, Sheikh Fadai, isn't it?
Yes. This book contains 7 volumes. Mm-hmm. It is published nowadays, and the language is Arabic. Abu Ali Ta'iri, talked about different kinds of transmitters of riwayah and hadith. For the importance of this book, Muntaha al-Maghal fi Ahwal al-Rijal, or we can say, I mean, when we talk about the importance of Rijal, we can say this is the weakness of the extremist in Shia, mm-hmm. I mean Akhbaris.
Yes.
Akhbarism in the in Akhbarism thinking, school of thought, they don't focus on this part, on this science. Maybe some of them had some works about Rijal, but they don't concentrate on that because all words and sentences called hadith, they accept that without searching about the roots.
Yes.
The importance of these kind of books is that if we want to relate something to our imam, our leaders, we should be sure that he himself said that. Mm-hmm. So 7 volumes of book for narrators, what does it mean? It means that you cannot make sure that something came from imam mm-hmm. before you search a lot. And this was a specialty. This was a special field of study that just some of the scholars paid attention to that. So it means that before searching about something, we cannot relate it to our leader. Why? Because this is our Islam, the book of guidance. If I narrate something that I'm not sure whether it came from my imam or not, How can I guide my people? How can I guide my society? What if this was a lie? As we know, a lot of liars narrated hadith. Of course, we cannot call them hadith. They claim that they were hadith.
Fake hadith, fabricated.
And
we have a lot.
We have a lot of fake hadith among our treasures of hadith. So we need some filter. That filter is this one of them, of course. Because we have ilmu diraya and we have ilmu rijal. In Rijal, we consider the one who transmitted.
Okay.
And in Diraya, we consider the text.
So Diraya is about the text of the Ahadith?
About the text of Ahadith. And Rijal is about the one, the transmitter of the Hadith, the narrator.
Uh-huh.
Before searching about these two parts, the one who narrates and something that he narrated. Before that, we cannot make a guidance book for the great world of Islam. So by these books, we can stop and we can fight extremism in both sides, denominations of Sunni and Shia, as he did so great.
So Muntaha al-Maqal, we can say by reading out and searching about the life accounts of the transmitters of hadith show us Which of them can be trusted and who are not.
As in the name of the title of book, we can see Muntaha al-Maqal fi Ahwal al-Rijal.
Rijal,
which is the plural of a rajul or man, not all the men. No, Rijal means the man who narrated. And of course, sometimes some women narrated, but it's a general name. Rajal means the narrators of Ahadith.
That's right. So many explanations or specific completions have been written on this book too. For example, Darvish Ali Hayri has compiled a treatise called Takmilat al-Rijal Abi Alib, which is about some of the names that might be missed by his professor. Book. And Sayyid Saduddin al-Amali, Sayyid Abu Turab Khoras Khansari, Mirza Hussain al-Nuri, and so many other outstanding scholars have written some explanations and interpretations on this book, Muntaha al-Maqal fi Ahwal al-Rijal. Anything missed, Sheikh Rouhani?
Okay. Oh, thank you very much.
The exact date and the demise of Abu Ali Hayri is not known, but something is known that he was from his Hajj pilgrimage back to the holy city of Najaf in the year 1216, and he was buried in Najaf. And some people might say that he was buried in the city of Karbala. It is not exactly known. Abu Ali Hayri, mainly known as the author of Muntaha al-Maqal fi Ahwal al-Rijal. Thank you much, Sheikh Fadai.
You're welcome.
And Sheikh Rouhani for a nice elaboration regarding the life account of this outstanding man. It was very kind of you. And thank you much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of the program The Teacher on Arab English Radio, Call of Islam page. For more information, visit our website at parstoday.ir/en Call of Islam page. To another episode introducing another Shiite dignitary. God bless you all. Fi amanallah.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
It's the show where we discuss the most topical of topics, the most controversial of controversies, and the most important affairs of affairs.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRB English Radio. Wherever you are, I hope you're doing well. This is your favorite program, Back to Reality. I am Asma. I have the pleasure to be your host. And just like the previous episode, I have the pleasure to be with the best of guests in here, Sister Zainab and Sister Bita.
Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners and my dear sisters. I am Bita. As you told me, I have the pleasure to be here again.
The pleasure is all mine. And you, Sister Zainab.
Assalamu alaikum to Sister Asma and Sister Bita and to all dear listeners. I'm Zainab and pleasure to be with both of you.
Well, you know, the concept of marriage is a very multidimensional topic. There are too many reasons related to a marriage and why right now in this modern age, the age for marriage has increased. One of the reasons is because when a woman gets to go for too much of high education and she becomes independent, she would no longer think of anyone fit enough to be her partner.
Yeah. You know, I do agree with this point that when you go to universities, you mm-hmm. have a higher level of education and you are, I don't know, more smarter, it will lead you to the point that, okay, nobody's perfect for me.
Yeah.
So when nobody's perfect for me, I don't need anyone in my life because my life is real.
Yeah.
I'm satisfied with that. See, so why should I screw it up?
I have a job. Yeah. I have money. I am the queen of my kingdom.
Exactly.
Then why do
I don't
I
need
have
a king to
bring
share my kingdom.
Yeah.
With.
So, Sister Zainab, help us. Why do I
disagree.
Have to
I disagree with both of you.
So?
Well,
and what are your reasons?
Yeah, we're all
for
not marrying, for being against you. I need a man because I'm not a man.
Fair enough.
I can go to all levels, whatever I want, but still mm-hmm. I can be man. Why we are created into different sexes? If we were supposed to be men, mm-hmm. then there was no need of another sex.
So
we are.
What are the options that these men will provide for you that you don't have it already? Maybe what Sister Zainab is trying to say is that just instinctively, by nature, we have been created as in two genders, like
yeah.
male and female, because we two can complete each other. Without one of us, the other one is just incomplete. And there's no doubt in this.
So where are you going to go? You have all those achievements. You have all that education.
Mm-hmm.
You have all those jobs. You have all that money. Where are you going next? What is next?
So let's go for a refreshment. We go for a break. And then we're going to tell you where we're going.
Yeah.
Yes, we're back. This is Back to Reality, and we're talking about the smart women who do not marry. And then Sister Zainab is telling us that where are we going? Well, we're going to improve ourselves all alone.
You know, let me tell you something. Supporting what Sister Zainab told up to here, I had a friend that I was like, okay, I don't need to marry anyone because I'm complete enough and perfect enough.
Mm.
And she was like, okay, when you get old, I don't know, like you are 58 or 60, you will
come
lack
to this
something.
Point.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And you will need someone next year. You will need children, not to feel alone and some things like that. You know?
And do you think it's right or no?
It may be right. You know, I'm not...
Totally,
it's not
right.
Maybe the first.
It's right.
Yeah, unfortunately,
the
first it is right. But you know, sometimes we forget the point.
Let me ask both of you. What about a small bud of plant that's there and it does not grow? It does not flourish at all. It is there, but it's
a
beautiful bud.
Well, it depends on the way you look at it.
It's so beautiful. It has like flourished so well, but it does not grow beyond that.
Mm-hmm. Well, it depends on the way you look at it. It's just a matter of perspective. You know, I may see a little flower on the ground and then I see it's flourished enough. But then to some people, maybe it's a little thing and it needs to be flourished.
The same flower is not helpful to the society. It does not bear fruit.
Now you're talking, yeah.
Yeah.
So she does not breed more of herself. You know what I mean? I mean, after a special age, after a certain age, as the biological clock is ticking for women, maybe you would think that, okay, I would have been a great mom and I would have had some children who would come to my grave at least.
talk about my name with others and things like this.
I have been, let me tell you, we are five sisters and we have no brother. Mm-hmm. And I have always trying to be tomboy in my family to actually fulfill that space of that not having a brother in the family. But I tried my level best. I could never do that. I could never fill the space of a boy.
Yes, because you're not a man.
Because you're
not
a man. This is clear. Yeah, so because that means we do need a man.
Yeah.
For the first and foremost thing that I have been feeling since my childhood.
Okay, sister,
and even right now is the security, the unconscious security you get by having a man. That's totally different. The peace you get.
Yeah. We have that experience with our fathers. Every single girl has that certain special feeling of security with her father. So we can understand that, of course, there are some men who would give you security and peace and, I don't know, whatever that is needed for you to feel so good
in your inner
soul. So
there should be your name tomorrow. This flourishing woman who achieved all her life, who tried so hard, who had such, we have something called a sadaqa jariya. It's not just your books. It's not just your good things. It's your good, it's your kids whom you actually brought up nicely.
We know we need it, there is in it, because we are human beings.
So now, we come to the main topic of our discussion. It was the fact that if a woman is more smart, if she has got more of education, then her choices of marriage are going to be lessened. Is that true?
That happens. Unfortunately, it does happen. And as we were discussing things, something clicked my mind. And just recently, I was invited here and there, just having trips getting awards, getting more success and all. And then when I we were staying in the family together, my father-in-law looked at me and said, "You don't seem to be fine. What's wrong with you?" And then he said, "You should be happy. You're achieving things day by day." And I said to him that I wish all these awards belonged to my husband. I feel like whatever the way, wherever I reach, even if I touch the sky, but still I am not Zainab. I am his wife.
Yeah.
And that's how I am known in the society. That's how I am known in the family. And that's how
I... So you love him so much. That's why.
Well, let me interpret it in my own way.
Yeah.
But I think, first of all, we have to understand that in the modern world, marriage is a choice for us now. It's not obligation. It's not anything else. It's a choice. That is recommended in our religion, of course. You know, we have many, I don't know, codes and so on, but it's told that you have to marry to complete your religion and so on. It means that, yes, we need it, okay? And sometimes we have to change
it's
our standards.
It's an obligation by nature.
Exactly. Somehow. Yeah. But it doesn't mean that if you don't marry, you lack something. No. We have some people, they may feel lonely, but so on. But they are still living.
Because to some people, not getting married is better than marrying someone who's going to destroy your notions of humanity.
And about the education and, the higher IQ of today's women, I think I want to add this point that sometimes education and IQ is not everything.
Yeah.
We have to change our
standards.
After
all, you're a woman and you have a heart and you're going to feel
exactly
the same emotions. IQ. Basically, you need a partner. You need, at a point of life, you need a partner who understands you intellectually, who understands you emotionally, and who understands you physically.
Mm-hmm.
Well, other two things, like understanding you intellectually and emotionally, you may
so,
find in the friends.
But finally, at this point, we come to this very agreement that as a woman, being a smart or not smart, educated or not educated, you need someone as a shoulder for yourself. You need someone to support you, to back you up, and
because Quran
to be your
that
friend.
It's half of your iman.
Yeah.
And Imam Ali al-Islam also says that if you want to follow the sunnah of Prophet, the best of the sunnah you can follow of Prophet is to get married.
Yeah. Yeah, and it has got so much of reasons, which is not the topic of today's discussion.
Yeah.
But then let's go for a break, and then afterward, we'll come with more of things to talk about.
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Back to Reality.
Welcome back. This is Back to Reality, and we're talking about women, smart women. And finally, we came to agreement that, okay, whoever you are as a woman, you have a heart, and eventually you might feel the need of a friend in your life, and that person is going to be your perfect patch for the rest of your life. Therefore, the need for a man to, complete you is something that has been put in your nature. So instinctively, pretty much naturally, there is a need for that. So how am I going to teach my daughter, the girl, who's so smart and educated, to understand that whoever you are, at the end of the day, you have to pick someone for yourself, because this is the thing that you have to do